Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth and marketing with business owners, thought leaders and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hi everyone and welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Today I'm speaking with Joe Santana. Joe, how are you today?
Hey, I'm great. How are you, Saul?
Yeah, really great. You're thank you so much for coming on the podcast. What time of day and where are you speaking from currently? What part of the world?
I'm in New York City right now, and let's see, it is 6 p.m. over here.
Ah, 6 p.m. What's the weather like over there at the moment?
It's pretty good. In fact, it's getting warm now. We had a time there where it was really confusing because in the midday, the temperature would gradually soar up almost into the 80s. But if you left the air conditioning on and it turned off in the middle of the night, it would drop down into the 40s. I'm talking about Fahrenheit here, not yeah. Celsius.
Yeah.
And then it would be freezing at night. But if you put the temperature on, then the heating system on, then it would get too hot in the afternoon. But now I think we're settling into that point where it's comfortable, cool in the evenings and the nights, and it's comfortable, warm during the day. So 75, maybe 78 Fahrenheit. I'm not sure what that is Celsius.
Yeah, no, I was just about to say too. I should know by now because I hear it so often because we've got Celsius over here in Australia and I never ever know. I should work that out because it's winter over here now. So our winter, and I promise I won't say how cold it is here because I know all the people who have proper cold climates always think it's really funny, you know, where right. people in Australia right. go, oh, it's really cold. Well, there actually are genuine cold parts, but Queensland's not really one of them. It's cold for us anyway.
It's almost like when people from Florida complain here in the United States that it's chilly. Like, no, not where you are. Not unless something dramatic has happened to our climate. You're not going to experience anything near what we experience here or in some of the middle states where it's even colder.
Yeah, well, you get it obviously snows there too, doesn't it, in winter sometimes.
It does. It does, although this year we got away without any snow. There hasn't been any snow in the end of 2022 and in the beginning of 2023. So
right.
The season's been rather mild by comparison.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, there's we got a property that's like a little bit sort of out bush, and like for me it's well, not really shocking, but interesting when you wake up in the morning, early in the morning, and there's frost / ice on the car window. That seems like a pretty big deal to me.
Yeah.
It's pretty, like, whoa, you know, you never see that. I could see heavy dew, but.
Absolutely. It's all perspective.
Yeah, no, that's right. Like it's still cold, but so tell everyone, for people who don't know about you, people who don't know what you do, can you give everyone just like a little bit of a sort of a snapshot overview about who you are, what you get up to, Joe?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm Joe Santana. I'm the chairman of a group called the CDO Power Circle, which is Chief Diversity Officer Power Circle. And Chief Diversity Officers here in the States are people who focus on how do you prepare an organization to be more effective as the workforce becomes more diverse? There are more women in the workforce, more of a variety of people than there were in, let's say, the middle toward the ending part of the 20th century. And it's even changing even more so as we go forward. My entry into this particular space is a little bit different. A lot of people that are in this space come out of careers in HR, training, development, and so forth. I actually ran an outsourcing organization where we had about 300 employees. We were a subset of a little company called Siemens that I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, who have locations all around the world. And it was during the time that I was running that operation that I became increasingly aware of the fact that as the workforce was changing, you had to learn how to be effective in supporting that new workforce that you had, as well as meeting the changing needs of clients that we were getting in order to be able to continue to grow. And that's when I realized not only is this a good thing to do, because of course I'd heard about it before, but there's a real practical reason for doing it. And it's becoming even more important as we move further into the future and between automation and shifts in population. The whole world's becoming more diverse and more interconnected. So that's kind of like my short story of how I went from being an IT outsourcing executive to now running an association for chief diversity officers.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Like I keep having to catch myself realizing we're actually in the 21st century because, you know, most people, with the exception of people who were born like after 2000, who were born into the 21st century, then, but it's one of those things that you only kind of reflect on and think about the 20th century as being in the past, you know, because most of our history and then things like workforce and things like any range of cultural factors, which are obviously a big part of what you sort of speak about, and then more and more people have to think about, because I guess the population, well, in many, not all, but in many places, probably would you say it's like fair to say that there is more cultural diversity, say, in the West with different cultures as opposed to in other countries where the range of different sort of cultures is not as diverse? Is that a true statement?
I think, though, what's happening, though, is with technology enabling people to live in one country and work in another country. And I mean, I'll give you an example of something interesting that I wrote about in one of my last books. Right around the time of the pandemic, there was an experiment going on in Japan where they started this little fake cafe where people would come in and order coffees and teas and so forth. And the servers were these little robots, these little robot droids that basically took the order and served the clients that were there. Now, the interesting thing about these robots is that they were not run by AI. They were actually drones that were being piloted by people that were bedridden, who in some cases lived several kilometers away from the coffee shop. About less than a year later, they actually had in Tokyo a functioning coffee shop where people that were operating robots from beds were able to serve their clients and interact with their clients. So literally, they've got a headset on and goggles, and to them, it's almost like a virtual reality interaction. To the client, they're interacting with the robot. Now, if you just take that as a signal of where we're going in the future, you think about this. There are a lot of jobs right now where people have to physically be in a place, like a warehouse job. What's to prevent having someone do that job who's in a totally different location, who's piloting a robot like that? The technology can be repurposed to do a lot of different things. So as a result of technologies like those, as a result of technologies like the way we're able to communicate right now between New York and Australia, and as a result of other new technologies that are coming up, plus the changing populations that are happening more in some places than in others, you've got a workforce that is entirely different and can potentially become even more different than the workforce of the 1950s and 60s. And the catch is that most organizations set up their policies, their practices, their procedures, their entire systems of how they support the success of their workers who serve their clients around a model of the mid-20th century. And that person that they're modeled to support, that man with the stay-at-home wife who looked like a popular TV show in the United States called Leave It to Beaver, that doesn't exist anymore, except maybe in little small pockets. So in order for organizations to be able to successfully attract, engage, deploy this new workforce, and serve these new clients, there's a lot of changing that has to happen to the institutions themselves and the policies and the practices that are designed to support them in their success, because they're designed for a different generation. So it's not just a matter of let's bring more women into the company, or let's bring in more people from country X or Y. It's also a matter of how do we rebuild and design our company to be successful in the 21st century? Because otherwise, it's the equivalent of if you built a house for giraffes back in the 20th century, you realize that now you need to have elephants working for you, but you have to get all the elephants to go on a diet so they can fit into a house built for a giraffe, rather than maybe expanding the walls, reinforcing the floor, and making the house better accommodate both giraffes and elephants. That's my analogy for that. So
that's analogy.
The big job for organizations that want to remain successful and want to grow and thrive in the 20th century.
I think you've actually touched on a really interesting point early in the conversation, which is that I find sometimes, I mean, not always, that sometimes the conversation around what we're sort of speaking out with, when people comment on online on diversity, inclusion, and those sorts of broad topics, is sometimes that conversation can be steered over to just a very high level conversation about whether that broadly, which is a very broad sort of topic overall, is right or wrong, which is always to me seems like a very sort of like strange approach, because it's so much more nuanced and so complicated and so sort of broad. Like even what you were saying then too, like things specifically that relate to technology is just one subtopic of that, as to how that enables like a range of different sorts of people to do new jobs that never existed before, that weren't even around, they didn't even exist, and then whilst that might then it's sort of often steered over to the topic of, well, that obviously means there's going to be less of other jobs. Well, like maybe that's true, but then the question arises, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that like when you're, say, speaking with companies, for example, who might be, can't really think of a specific industry, but some in somebody's company, maybe where they were doing more manual tasks, and those people might have to sort of change or be moved out of that into other things that are more technology related. Are those sorts of topics things that have sort of come across your conversations with people? Do you talk to them about that?
Yeah, I mean, those topics always come up. And I think that the reason for that is obviously people, tool up to do a particular type of work, and then they focus on doing that work. But I always tell organizations and people the same thing when it comes to these opposing forces. I, as you probably figured out by now, by some of the way I language things, I'm a futurist, and I tend to look at things in terms of where are they going and where are they heading and how do we prepare for that. And when I'm looking at these organizations and I'm looking at their future outcome, I tend to look at everything that's coming out of the organization as being either a signal or being noise. And signals tell you pretty much where things are probably going to land, not with certainty, but with enough information to give you a sort of cone of possibilities. It could happen like this. It could happen like that. And we can prepare for those 2, 3, 4, or 5 outcomes. And barring any, black swans, maybe we'll have a good plan in place by the time these things happen. Noise, on the other hand, tends to come in the form of unsubstantiated opposition. And I'm not saying the opposition is not grounded in real fears and real needs that people have. But the bottom line is, think about it this way. Centuries, a couple of centuries ago, when the Industrial Revolution started, machines were being built. And there were people, the Luddites, you know, who threw their shoes into the machines and they tried to muck up the works because they saw this as endangering their practices as textile workers and so forth. Fast forward, the Industrial Revolution continued, the Luddites are gone, things changed. Years ago, when cars first came on the road, people used to complain that they were noisy, they were dangerous to bicycle riders, they were dangerous to horses. All that clamoring that happened back then, and today we have roads full of cars, the horses are mostly gone, except in a couple of small places. So the point is that when planning, whether you're planning as an individual, your career, or you're planning for your business, it's important to pay attention to the signals and to plan according to signals and not according to noise. If there's a new technology out there that can, let's say, for example, you know, blow the top off a mountain, which there is, and make it easier to extract coal and extract natural gas, and I see that technology taking off and I'm a coal miner, I have one of two choices. I can rail against the machine, or I can go take an online course and figure out how to use it so that when those jobs come up, I'm in line to take one of those over because I prepared for it. So I always say prepare for the signals, not for the noise, because once something starts, it's like right now we've got, if you look at the demographics of the United States, there are lots of different predictions, but one of the ones that I like the best is from the United States Census, which states that the people that are now considered the various minorities that are in the United States, so Asians, African Americans, so forth, those people collectively will be the majority of the population of the United States by the year 2045. That is demographic destiny. That's not noise. That's a fact. That's going to happen. Now, are there people that rail against, you know, the changes that are happening and what's going to happen? Yes. So did the Luddites. So did the horse and buggy people, right? The things are that are going to really make a difference are going to be those facts. And so when I talk to organizations or if I talk to an individual, I always say, pay attention to the signals, use those to determine what opportunities might show up that you can seize, what obstacles might show up that you need to prepare for so that you can either circumvent or you can maybe turn into an advantage, and try to block out the noise because the noise is not that useful.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Joe. I think the thing too that I've observed, which is I've found sort of quite curious, is as an example of say that level of change coming full circle, even too, because there's always fear. And like you said, like, you know, rightly so, like people feel like they've got families to feed, they've got, you know, mortgages to pay, and rightly so, like people are obviously fearful of losing their job and say not being able to skill up or be left out in the cold whilst the rest of the world moves forward. But then you see what I consider to be like a great example of things coming full circle of say you know, through, very broadly speaking, like through the whole period after the Industrial Revolution and things being mass manufactured and maybe like a fall of, you know, of the small local sort of craft industries and people doing things individually as like craftspeople or, you know, or say guilds and things like that, which is obviously further back. But now you see, thanks to the internet and thanks to lots of different platforms that, you know, like say things like Etsy or not even those platforms, but like the opportunities that has actually given then individuals to actually showcase like amazing you know, creativity. Like we're an example of that. Like I would, you know, the opportunities that have come through not only like through search, but people going I've got an idea, and even now on my own, like as an individual, you can, even without extra help, you can go online fairly easily and you can showcase any number of things in a way that to me is very much like the sort of the local experience that people used to have with their village or their town, but on them being able to take that to like a worldwide platform, but in a way they're still doing their own little thing. And I think that's kind of curious in this, and I guess why I'm saying that is because it's easy to, at the time when change is happening like you were talking about, and you've got a certain amount of fear around that, you don't always know or, you know, sort of expect or even know that somewhere in the future it's going to come full circle again. But, you know, it often, like in that example, I've always felt, especially in recent years, that somehow things do. And then at some point, people also sort of long for some experience from the past or some way of doing things from the past. And you've got your people doing, you know, if you look on sort of YouTube or anywhere, there's any number of amazing things with people creating handmade products and things that they can platform in a way that they would never have been able to in the past. So
yes,
you've got this sort of funny thing happening. But like when you work with say an organization, Joe, do you end up speaking to like the individuals, the people actually in the organization too?
What I do primarily, Saul, is I train the people who are responsible for helping the organization to make those transitions. So I provide training to the strategist, which is the chief diversity officer. That usually is the person who's helping the company put a strategy together in that area. And I also train a lot of the people who lead community groups. Sometimes I think in some countries they call them staff networks. In other companies they call them resource groups. So they have women's groups. They might have a veterans groups. So I help to train those different groups to be effective in helping their community and their whole company make that transition into an organization that's more effective with the new members, you know, that they have now, the new workforce members, and of course also the new market that they have. And so those programs take up a lot, and they take pretty much, if I were to go like very quickly through five of them, three for the chief diversity officers and two that I do for the resource group leaders. The three for the chief diversity officers is one called Sharpening the Axe. And there I bring in thought leaders from different walks of life, authors of books on different topics, everything from emotional intelligence to the developments in AI. So it's a whole gambit there. And it's to give them a preview of what's the latest in certain other adjacent disciplines and what's coming up ahead. Because a lot of planning has to be based on where are we and what's coming up ahead and how do we bridge those two. So we want to give them that dimension of foresight so that they see what's coming up. I have a newsletter that I put out quarterly called Trends in DEI that basically shows them again what's going on and what implication does that have for you. Like, for example, a lot of organizations, the way they used to pull their people together, especially their women's groups and their veterans groups, was they'd get them all together in a conference room and they have speakers and so forth. Well, today, a large percentage of the workforce is not in the same building. So what do you do now in order to create that environment in the absence of that old platform that you had before where everybody was going into the same building? So topics like that, again, it's looking at where the trends are going. And then we have a Future Foresight Summit, again, as the name implies. What I look for is to get leaders to come in and thought leaders and authors and academics and to talk about where the world is heading in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, and get them to start thinking about, well, what do we need to be doing now? So we're ready for that. And then for the ERG leaders, it's more tactical. It's more, how do you support this strategist in the execution pieces of this strategy for your community? So we have something called the ERG Power Talk Discussions. Again, different thought leaders come in. I bring in these different community leaders. They get an opportunity to learn from these thought leaders. I record my interviews with the thought leaders, which is actually the kernel or the core information inside my podcast. What I don't record is the exchange with the members that the thought leader has. Mm-hmm. And then we have something called the Virtual Academy, where we bring together a lot of these leaders and teach them some really basic stuff. A lot of people that lead these communities, they're not experienced managers per se. They're more of the doer category. So in many cases, this community that they're leading is the first time that they've had a leadership role, or they're pretty early in their leadership role experience. So this gives them an opportunity to learn some basic things like planning, like how do you set up a mentoring circle? How do you do these different things so that you can leverage that group more effectively? So I essentially work through them to provide them with the tools they need to then help the organization to go through the transitions that they need to go to in order to continue to be successful into the 21st century.
And what's one of the most, I've been doing this for a while, I assume. So what's one of the, like you would have seen, I'm sure a lot of different sorts of ways that people work with each other. What's like from what you're doing, what's one of the most satisfying and rewarding things that you get out of what you do, Joe?
For me, I think one of the most rewarding things is when I actually see that people are able to connect with each other, learn from each other, and grow from each other. Because I'm a big believer in the fact that there is seldom the right opinion or the right perspective. There are perspectives in the plural. And I use the old story of the Indian blind men who were taken into this little area and told to touch this elephant from different, positions. So one of them grabbed the tail and said, it's a wire. Another one grabbed the ear and said, it's a fan. Another one, the leg, and said, it's a big column. And then they began to argue with each other about who was right. No, it's a fan. But if they had just put together the pieces that they had, they would have come much closer to realizing that a creature that had all those components was very likely an elephant. So I'm a big believer that when you start pulling together the different perspectives that people have, you learn a lot more. And I personally get a tremendous amount of personal reward from just interviewing people, talking to different companies, and working with different people, different thought leaders, because you just learn so much little nuances that bring to life and bring into clarity things that maybe you couldn't see from a different perspective. So it's something that I enjoy doing, and I enjoy seeing other people also when they get the joy of that gestalt of saying, I've got it. I've got the solution to this now from these different pieces. So I think at heart, I'm a teacher at heart.
Yeah, no, very true. Like it's, I'm surprising. I think like the power of simply just having like outside of the specific problem solving aspects, like you were talking about people piecing things together, like the power of just a simple conversation of people having like some powerful sort of realization. I mean, I have to say too, I mean, even in our conversation now and with other people that we're done other podcasts with, it's one of the most like even on the podcast level, like it's a great and incredibly interesting to me hearing other people's perspectives on like any number of things. And I think that sort of point is a, for me anyway, it's like a really underrated aspect of bringing people together. If you want to say, like what are the top best ways like to bring people together who would otherwise on the face of it, you know, they might have you go, you're from here and you're from here. You know, traditionally you've had problems with each other. But ultimately, like I've found, you know, everybody makes assumptions about other people, rightly or wrongly. You assume things, but when people are just having a chat and they're just like one to one, a lot of those things seem to disappear. You know, yes. They seem to like magically just poof, they're gone.
Yes.
It's not really surprising to me because I know that's a thing, but still amazes me that the answer seems sort of so simple. And yet, you know, it's sort of, I guess part of that, there's that great aspect that assists with that very thing we're talking about in relation to the internet. And it's also one of the bad things about the internet is that you get, it's one of the great, like both simultaneously get a little snapshot, which is, I have a theory about why, you know, podcasts are so popular now too, you know, just across the board. There's obviously there's some really key figures of people that do great podcasts, but long form conversations, you know, I think it's actually a myth that I think it's just a straight out myth that, you know, people actually would rather have like quick, they need things like fast and quick. And I think that's proven not to be the case because podcasts are so popular, like long form conversations where there's no punchy, you know, there's no quick, you know, fast pace stuff sort of happening. There's just often two or more people just having a chat and people love listening to it because it's like, it's like you're just in the room with them and you're listening in a conversation. And that to me is just like straight out evidence that, you know, all the other stuff is just a straight out myth, you know, as people get used to it. Yeah, true. And they get like trained to be like exposed to fast, punchy, fast paced sort of imagery. And I mean, there's kind of in its own merits, there's sort of nothing really wrong with that, except when it then, you know, says everything else is wrong.
Yes.
Not good and not worthy enough. Like it's okay. You could look, you know, there's heaps of things that I would look at and I'd go, yeah, that's great. It's fast. It's action. Fine. But not then when it's, you know, saying everything else is boring or not sufficient or too slow or.
Yeah. Once you find yourself, you know, if I find myself or anyone else making some sweeping generalization, I suspect that it's probably wrong because of the variety of tastes that are out there. It's like, no, everyone likes, you know, of course everyone's going to like this type of music because it's so energetic. Not necessarily, right? And then there was something else that you said that I wanted to go back to real quick, which is that And this is the good news for workplaces is that when we get to know each other better, when we're in situations where we get to know each other better, we realize, as the poet Maya Angelou said, and I'm not going to be able to quote her words exactly, but just roughly what she said was that we always learn that we're more alike than we are unlike each other. And in many cases, the differences that we have that sometimes keep us from being effective with each other are differences in how we convey or how we express certain particular basic emotions and connections that everybody has. So, you know, everybody has certain basic connections and the way that they work and connect with other people, but we don't express it all in the same way. I remember a client of mine who did something a couple of years ago, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. What they did was they wanted the people who worked in there, they were in a healthcare space, and they wanted the people who worked there to get to know each other better and to appreciate each other better and be able to work with each other more effectively. So they created this little booklet that looked like a passport. And on that booklet, they had this game. They gamified this entire journey where every person who had one of these little booklets would have to go and enjoy a religious dinner of another faith at a colleague's home. So find a colleague that would invite you to their home for some religious dinner that was of a faith different than your own. Go to a museum that displayed information that was different from that which was part of your cultural background. And they had a whole bunch of things like this. And they called it the Amazing Race. And they would give out these small prizes for people who got to tick off more of the boxes that they had experienced all these different things. But it had a tremendous impact on the people who actually went through it because it raised their awareness of, oh, he or she does that because that's their way of expressing this particular connection or feeling, which I too have, but I don't express it that way. But we do have that in common. So organizations that are looking to build connection, that's one way to do it, is to give people that opportunity to get to know each other and appreciate each other better.
Yeah. I think that's a fantastic story. And it is, like, it also sort of resonates just what probably just thinking back to different conversations you have with, say, like, you know, even us having a chat now, but other people you met like for the very first time, and you there's like certain points in the conversation where you'll just go, oh, that, you know, their approach that's originally sounds different, there's often little part of it that is quite similar to like something you've thought. And even like those little moments can mean like a translation, you know, to just feeling that a little bit more close to the person, you know, on that human sort of level, I suppose, because it's, but I mean, once again, it just gets back to the fact that it's actually after the fact, like in retrospect, it always seems quite simple.
Sort of, yeah, it does. Like
you go, yeah. Oh, wow, that was easy. You know, it didn't, yeah. You know, you have this, because things always grow in your mind, don't they? And they always kind of become bigger in your mind. Yeah. There's actually a really funny, there's this big piece of street art down in Brisbane where you come across this bridge called the Story Bridge. And you go down, and I'm often driving, and you drive down this tunnel, and there's this big piece of street art that says, and it's been there for years. It was by a local artist. I can't remember who it was, but it's been there for years, and it was an art project, and it's just big words that just says, "The more you think about it, the bigger it gets." And
yeah,
and it's a, you know, it's obviously got a range of connotations, but it's also, you know, every time I drive past it, it's this reminder of you know, things, either things you worry about or things that, or whatever they are, they get bigger, like the more you focus on it, until then sometimes you're like snapped out of it in like a conversation where someone's is like, oh, that's like smashed my worldview about what I thought. Which is, and it didn't take much.
Yeah, no, exactly. And see, that phenomenon of fixating in a certain way on how we think about something and not noticing other things that are happening around us, that sort of, I think the term for that is attentional blindness that we all have. I have it, you have it, we all have that. It afflicts business owners and leaders sometimes in a way that's detrimental to their business. If they don't pay attention to that, if they don't realize that that's there, that we have the horse blinders on and that we occasionally have to peek around the corner a little bit to see what's going on. You were talking about something else that I can provide you an example of that phenomenon right now. In the United States, after the COVID-19 pandemic, or after the vaccine came out and things started to die down a little bit, the unemployment rate was hovering somewhere around 3.5. And organizations, of course, expected that that might go up at some point. And it didn't. It stayed at 3.5. A number of people post-COVID decided that they didn't want to work in the companies they were in anymore, and they left. And mysteriously, the number stayed at 3.5. Then some of the tech companies started laying people off because they were excited by the whole situation of increased use of technology right after COVID started. They made big bets and big investments and then realized, well, maybe we overhired. So they started to lay people off, and the unemployment rate stayed at 3.5. So I was giving a presentation. I was doing a keynote at an event, and I was curious about this because I thought this is meaningful. How can people leave their jobs and the unemployment rate remains almost unchanged? And companies let people go and the unemployment rate remains unchanged. And then I started looking at some other numbers, and one of the numbers that caught my eye ties right back to what you were talking about before, about how the internet and the tools that we have today make it so easy for people to start their own businesses, get side jobs, do a number of different things. So I started looking at those numbers, and guess what? They were going straight up. It was almost like a hockey stick effect. So here's one of the things that organizations need to be aware of as we move further into the 21st century. Workforce becomes more diverse. World becomes more interconnected. Some organizations literally refuse to adapt to this new workforce. They want everyone to work as if we were still living in the 1950s. Bend yourself, go on a diet if you're an elephant so you can fit through the door. But here's the other thing that they have to consider. Whereas in the past, we were a society that was made up of an increasing number of people that were employed by other people, the tide has turned a little bit, and more people are increasingly going into their own businesses. And I'm not just talking about virtual assistants or other roles like that. I'm talking about people who are brokers or financial planners or other higher end, higher education type roles, who decide that their lot is better if they go off on their own as opposed to going to work for a company. There are a lot of people, for example, in the United States who are African American and women who feel like their opportunities for financially gaining and moving forward in their career is probably better if they hang their own shingle than if they go work for a company and try to convince the company to give them a fair break and let them advance. Mm-hmm. And to me, what that means for organizations is that you're not only competing for this workforce between yourself and your immediate competitors or industrial equivalents, you're also competing with the alternative of they could be doing something else on their own. There are so many opportunities out there, not just to start your own business if you have an interest in a particular area, but to even sell the skills that you have on the public market and make money that way. There are people that have two or three of these different types of jobs who make salaries that rival the salaries of people that are putting in 18-hour days at an organization. So the competition is heating up. And part of the reason why those numbers are staying the same is because not everybody who exits a company goes into the pool that's waiting for another company to hire them. Some of them are slipping out of that and they're going off into their own businesses, and they're exiting that pool that's available now to corporations. And a lot of them don't want to come back after they've tasted being able to go out and be on their own.
Exactly. I mean, I relate to that very strongly too, because I mean, in our industry, I'm seeing, you know, a lot of small business owners, but also like not only existing businesses, but we deal with like a lot of people who are, I mean, I can think of a few off the top of my head, just sort of recently, people who used to work for somebody else, even in trades, who used to work for other people, who probably as a result of the sort of catalyst that was COVID, that who reflected on their lives, reflected on their family, reflected on what they want to do in the future. Maybe that they always wanted to do that too, which is I've had some conversations with people, you end up just having a chat and oh yeah, it's great, you're starting a new business. And many people have wanted to do it for a long time, but they it's almost like they needed a catalyst to do it, which is not really that uncommon. I mean, I suppose, you know, people actually just going, okay, well, now the time is right, you know, to actually do that.
Yep. And on the flip side of that, where you see, you know, that organizations might face constraints in terms of getting people to work for them and be able to match the needs of this new market that's emerging as well, is the fact that when people try to stay where they are in the company, but to begin to modify the policies and practices to make them more acceptable to a 21st century workforce, the companies resist. So, for example, when people who post-COVID started thinking about maybe I should spend more time with my family, or maybe I should, you know, spend more time with my friends, organizations label that quiet quitting. You're no longer here all the time, and you actually want to take advantage of this thing that we've been talking about, work-life balance, but that we never intended anybody to really use that. And so there's a resistance there, right? The other is you have...
It's a terrible term, quiet quitting.
Quiet quitting is... And then when they describe quiet quitting, they describe quiet quitting as, well, the person does their job. They come in the morning. They leave in the afternoon when they're supposed to, or they do it remotely, however they do it. But they don't put in that extra effort. They don't stay those extra hours. They don't. So in other words, what it means is they put boundaries around their life because they realize that there's more to life than just being a productive tool all the time, right?
Yeah.
That's normal. I think that's mentally healthy, actually. Mm-hmm. But they put it, but in the United States especially, the word quitting is almost, it's almost the up there with a curse word, because quitters never win and winners never quit, right? And we're loaded with sayings about grit and sticking to it.
Yeah.
So just calling it quiet quitting is to make it sound very distasteful. The other is, during the pandemic, you had people who work remotely. The organizations kept running, but then the heads of the organization are saying, well, that's over. Now you have to come back to work. They've already been working. They didn't stop working. They were working from a different location. Well, no, but they have to come back to the office because we need to preserve the car. I mean, there's all of these excuses. Again, it's the cars are bad because they knock people off bicycles and they can hurt our horses. It's the same noise. And so what happens is you have people who turn around and say, I don't want to live the 1950s lifestyle. I live in the 21st century and I have the obligations I have and the desires I have. And the organization's demands are no longer compatible with what it is that I want and my family wants. And so they leave. The interesting thing is that I ran across this study, and it's by a reputable organization. It's McKinsey. And they did a study. They had 73 CEOs and they asked them, what are the most important things that you're focusing on in 2023? And you had, of course, technology. You had some of the other global events that are going on. And there were 12 items that were on this list. And dead last as the lowest of all their concerns was some of the issues that are going on in the race, ethnicity, and the culture and the genders and the workforce. That was dead last. That is short-sighted, because unless you have people that you can engage in your organization who are in touch with the market, which is also changing, you're going to become irrelevant. And all the other problems are going to become non-issues because you're not going to have a company to worry about navigating through the other problems. So it's interesting that we are sitting right now at a point where we're an inflection point where organizations, it's almost like climate change. We still have time to reverse some of the damage that we've done. But if we wait long enough, we won't have that time anymore. Right now, organizations can position themselves in such a way that will help them attract the top talent from that workforce, be able to resonate perfectly and pivot their organizations to continue to be meaningful and relevant with this new market that's emerging. Or they can continue to act like they're living in the 1950s until it becomes evident that we're not.
I find there's a point of view that I've sort of, observed, say, in different things online where I guess there's an assumption by, you know, certain people in society that say if you're looking for, you know, if employer A is looking for a person in a certain field and you're trying to implement, more, you know, in inclusion from other sort of races or other types of people that haven't traditionally, say, even in that industry, been a part of that industry. If I was to say, it might be like engineers, for example, you know, or someone like that. There's sort of this thing that I've observed happening where there's an assumption made that, like, if you're going to be employing a new person, that still the idea of being more inclusive isn't necessarily the smartest one, because it's more likely that, say, men are going to be the people who are going to be the best candidates for that. But and whilst I'm not educated enough, say, about that a particular group of people to actually have like a proper opinion anyway, but I guess what it does for me is it makes an assumption that the horse is already out of the gate before you even see like who's going to be in the race, you know, as you go, you would assume that it's going to be this. And I mean, there might still be a majority of people, as opposed to still giving like the other people in the race even a chance, you know, in the first instance. And yeah, like I feel that that's, you know, there's sort of truth on both sides of the fence. But like if you still don't give other people a chance because your assumption is so powerful and that it should be this way, because it's just going to make, you know, there's this sort of thing that I'm not sure if this is the right way to say it, but it sort of seems like to me, it's like, oh, well, it's going to make everyone's life a bit easier if we don't have to do this other stuff, instead of, you know, just being kind of like at least trying to sort of at the expense of finding the best candidate. I mean, I suppose there's that angle of like we won't find the best candidate because we're like pushing things being inclusive too much, you know, or something like
that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's definitely one of the things that organizations sometimes feel, and they may not say it out loud, but that's one of the things that they're concerned about. Yeah. Well, here's the thing though, that's really interesting here. Back in the 1980s or so, there was this philosophy that emerged that now permeates a lot of organizations, and it's really embedded deeply in a lot of organizations. And that philosophy is that if you bring together a group of people who bond well together because of their similarities and because of their, because they have perspectives that are somewhat similar, And those perspectives that are somewhat similar also bond very well with the organization's leadership and direction. You've got a rock star team, right? Now, new studies, now we're talking about, that was the 20th century. Now let's move into the 21st century. 21st century studies show that when you bring together a team of people that are different from each other and that bring different perspectives, that's when you get innovation. Not so much when you bring a bunch of people together who see the world somewhat similarly. A great example of that that was recently, a couple of years ago in a movie, was the invention of the, I'm forgetting the fella's name right now, but it was the life story of the gentleman who actually broke the German Enigma machine. And
I think I know the one you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. And the way that he did it, which was really different, was that so the British government had all of these different mathematicians and specialists in various types of codes and so forth working on this, couldn't crack it because the code kept changing every so often, I think on a regular basis. And they hired this guy. He's the, what the movie's all about. It's his biography. They hired this brilliant man, and he went out and he created a team of people, or he augmented the team with people who were not your typical academics, your typical mathematicians. He got people on the team that were experts at breaking crossword puzzles. He actually ran a contest to get one of the team members based on who performed the best in figuring out crossword puzzles. And by bringing this eclectic group of people together with different types of skills, different types of ways of thinking, they ultimately broke the code that no one else could break. So organizations, in many cases, still operate under this belief that if we just get everybody who went to, you name the school, and they're all brilliant, and they're all and they all hold these values that we treasure, we've got a rock star team. But a lot of the recent science shows not true. In many cases, when we pull together this group of people that are different from each other and we get them to look at the problem from different perspectives, like our old Indian parable of the blind man and the elephant, together they can collectively figure out what it is that this problem is and how to solve it much better than everybody who's touching only the tail of the elephant, as it were.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I, when I talk to organizations about this and to my group members, is the focus today should be, I think, more on adding to your culture than basically getting more people that fit into your existing culture. So if you've got a team, and let's assume that they're all equally qualified, they're all qualified, and you're bringing in a new candidate into that team, and of your candidate pool, they're all equally qualified. Today, what a lot of organizations do is what they use to divide who they're going to pick is culture fit. So they'll say, okay, so all these people here are qualified. Which one fits best into our culture? And what I'm saying is, flip that and ask yourself, all these people here are qualified. Which one adds the most to our culture? Could be a woman. It could be a person of a different background altogether, racially, ethnically, because they had a different life experience. It could be someone from a different educational background. Whatever that element is, you want to expand that aperture of your culture as opposed to narrowing and tightening the focus. And as the marketplace becomes more diverse, that becomes more important, because when you've got multiple people in the room, you know, I heard a story someone told me recently that they started this small study group to determine, you know, products that this company had. Actually, the company was Johnson & Johnson, the maker of Band-Aids. And they had one Band-Aid that's supposed to be like the invisible Band-Aid that you can put on. And, you know, that was invented 100 years ago. And now the organization's become more diverse. And there was this African-American woman there who said, well, if I put that Band-Aid on my finger, it's not invisible. Can we make it in a different shade, right? And they thought about it and they said, sure, we can. And boom, they opened up another market as a result of that, that can now look at this and say, oh, I can pick my own shade of invisible Band-Aid. Another company, a pharma company, was trying to figure out, well, why is it that we cannot effectively market our product to certain groups of people? And in pharma, basically what they do is they take their, let's say their medication, their pills and so forth. They send them to a pharmacy. They go into a big bin and then your doctor writes you a script. They then take from that bin, they make the order of 60 or 90 pills and then you pick them up. But if you don't pick them up after a certain number of days, they go back into the bin. If they become stale because they're not picked up over a period of time, then they become shrinkage in terms of your inventory, or they have to go back to the pharma company. So the pharma company wanted to know what's going on. Why aren't people picking up these meds? How do we increase people picking up their meds and address this problem? And they got a brilliant idea. They had all these different groups in the organization that represented different cultural groups that were similar to some of the clients that weren't picking up these medicines. They had them ride along with the salesman to the pharmacy. They had them look at the commercials. They had them give them all types of feedback, took all the feedback, made some minor superficial changes to where they placed their ads, how they did certain things. Bottom line, in that year, they made $1 billion in added revenue. Mm. Culture ad, pretty powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Small changes, big effects, hey? I would actually just like to ask a question about, like from your perspective. I mean, when you were talking, just listening before about talking about the culture in a business and people saying you would fit or not fit into the culture. How many organizations do you think really, and I mean not just high level saying our culture, you wouldn't fit into our culture, how many organizations or people who are actually saying that would actually really know what their culture is? Like, I know that sounds like a really obvious question, but I mean, I'm just making an assumption here, mm-hmm. but I'm saying, there's a difference for me between saying what your culture is and knowing what your culture is. Like because I could say, our culture is, we've got a relaxed sort of workplace. We, we do this and this. But I mean, how does that actually mean you know your culture? And the reason why I'm saying that is because then even saying our culture is this to me sounds more like there's a fear of just a introduction. It's less about you don't fit into our culture, and for me more about there's a fear of introducing like another aspect into it that might cause problems, that it's not really about I know my culture and you don't fit into it. Like, it's kind of something else for me. It doesn't really because I mean, to actually to quantify, to drill down and go, I mean, even if I had to think about what our culture is like, to actually put it into words and know it and have it sort of systematized in a way, so much so that you actually know who does and doesn't fit into it, to me sounds like pretty difficult.
It is. There's an illusion. There's an illusion there that we can dispel pretty quickly. So generally, organizations have what they call their culture, which are generally a bunch of slogans like, we value this, we value that. I mean, there are pieces of software out there that can generate those for you if you want, right? And those tend to be sort of the really high-level aspirations of the organization. Now, the lived experience of people inside the organization and what they perceive to be the culture of the organization, especially in a large company that has, let's say, 5,000, 6,000, 10,000, 20,000 employees, the culture of the organization will vary from level and office to office and group to group, depending on the dynamics of the people that are inside that group, because they will all be under maybe the same policies and the same rules and regulations, but they'll interpret them differently. They will perceive them differently, depending on their own backgrounds and their own biases that we all have. They'll perceive them in a different way. So a lot of times, someone who is in one part of an organization, let's say, gets hired into one part of the organization, and they think, oh, this person is a great culture fit. They're wonderful and they're brilliant. And then they put them on a fast track, and then they put them on some kind of list where they can move on at some point to another part of the organization. And let's say another part of the organization takes them, and suddenly their performance tanks, or the manager at the other side doesn't think that they're as brilliant or as wonderful. Why? Because somewhere between that hallway that's 50 feet away and the other group that's sitting over there, there are actually differences in what it is that they value and how they value it. So I always look at the statements that a company puts out as being nice aspirational statements. There's somewhat of a PR spin, but the reality of the culture that people experience within an organization has to do with the collective lived experiences of the people that are there. And some people, obviously, in shaping that culture than others within each team, because they have a larger role as a leader and as a role model for everyone else. So, yeah, it's more of an illusion. And unfortunately, the higher up you go in an organization, especially a big organization, the more isolated they are from what's actually happening in the world. In fact, employees tend to be more in touch with the tastes and the changes in the market than the leadership does, because the leadership is removed somewhat from that in many cases as a result of economic prosperity, where they live, who they interface with, who they talk to, and what they, you know, what supports the beliefs that they have. So it's important, especially at a point like where we are today, where we're moving deeper into this new century, it's important for leaders to really be good listeners and to listen to what others have to say about the culture within the organization and outside the organization. Because very likely those experiences that their employees are having are more aligned with the experiences of their market. The shoe executive at the top does not know the Nike shoe wearer as well as the employee who sees them, you know, in the same restaurant and in the same supermarket on a regular basis. So
who's like trying the shoes on, who's actually putting the shoes on them.
That's correct. Really important to do that, to listen and to understand that when I talk about culture, what I mean is that in a team, you want to have as many. I don't need 10 Joe Santanas working with me. I need a Saul. I need a Frank. I need a Mike. I need a Jane. I need Lily. I need all these different people, especially depending on the market that I'm working with, who can give me different aspects of the elephant, so that we don't all sit there and say, I wonder why this doesn't work. I mean, we agree it's a tail, right? Or it's a fan. Yeah. We need that larger perspective. So whatever team it is that we have, we want to make sure that that team can give us those different pieces that we need to operate in this world that's much more diverse and complex than it ever was before.
What do you think about this idea, Joe, which is that I feel too that when people say, I'm just getting back to, I guess, the part of the conversation about where people are wanting people to fit or to fit into their culture, and we've already gone over that, and then the risk, unless I call it the risk or the fear or whatever emotion they might have about then having some new either cultural group or new type of people in their business. Like I feel that that it might almost be more about the perceived risk, which is, you know, is probably sort of largely unfounded, that introduction of someone else, like of even just as a general idea, that's a more powerful idea for people not doing it, because people want or like to have, I guess to some extent, understandably, they want like a guarantee that if they get a certain sort of person because they think it's worked before, that if they have the same thing happen again, that's more of a guarantee, as opposed to going, you know, there's always going to, let's just assume there's always going to be an element of risk, because if you introduce like different ideas, some of those ideas are going to fail. You know, they're not all actually going to be like what you think is going to be. Yeah, you know, it's like, I mean, I didn't certainly coin this phrase, but like when we're doing, or when I'm doing, you know, a brand job for somebody or any creative pursuit, and I'm sure like a lot of people are similar, there's an element of like the happy accident that I sort of term it, that you have to, in order to get to some really interesting idea, you have to take like certain risks and do and throw in a few random elements. And there's always, and just so long as you accept that the process of doing that is going to certainly at some point lead to some level of failure, the acceptance of that is, I think, actually a really underrated point. You kind of need to accept that so that you don't get too hung up on, like, you got to have a guarantee, you know, and that.
Yeah.
But through the process, like, you'll have a few little gems will come out of it that you wouldn't otherwise have, because like you just said, the same old, you know, the whole time. And what do you think about that sort of that random element? To me is kind of an underrated point, you know, in my mind. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that we get the most value and learn the most in situations where we're dealing with people, or we bring people into our organization who have a different way of looking at the world and different perspectives. We don't get that when we bring people in and form an echo chamber and we run into the same problems. You know, if you look throughout the history of different types of inventions and so forth that have been created, they usually were created by outsiders, not insiders. Mm. It wasn't the person inside the profession that came up with the new idea. It was the outsider that came in and looked at the same problem but saw something different. When people who, let's say, for example, who travel to different countries, live in different countries, have a different set of experiences. And I recently read about a chef who has these amazing creations, has this place out in New York City, but he's lived like in half a dozen countries, came from outside the United States, so his base knowledge of cooking is different. And then he added all this other stuff to it. So I go back to my example of the blind men and the elephant. We have to be willing to teach what we've learned from our perspective, and we have to be willing to learn what others have learned from their perspectives. And Are we always going to get the right answers and so forth? Of course not. There's a measure of experimentation, to your point, that goes on. But you're not going to build an organization in the world that's constantly changing as fast as this one is by standing pat on one way of doing things with one group of people that all look at it the same way. That train has left the station at this point.
Yeah, I think it has. I think it has, Joe. Would you say, like, how relevant is what you're doing, like, say, for small businesses? Is it just as relevant, like, for small business as it is, like, for medium to large organizations?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think that one of the things that happens sometimes to small businesses is that they start out with a core group of people, maybe two or three people who know each other, and they feel, well, we're going to build this up first, and then after that, we'll start exploring how to bring different ideas in and different people. And, you know, you'll have a company that has maybe 50 people, and they'll say, well, we're not big enough, you know, to concern ourselves at this point still. I would disagree with that. I would say that from the very beginning, you can benefit from that diversity of thought. From the very beginning, by bringing in all these different people that have these different perspectives to work with you on different things, you can have aha moments and opportunities that may have passed you by. And the other thing is that if you build that in very early into your organization, when your organization is either a startup or relatively small, it becomes part of your DNA. It becomes built in so that as you grow, you can scale it as you get larger. And there's a number of ways of doing it. Like, for example, if you do not need that many employees where you're going to have all of these different groups possibly represented in your employees to give you these different perspectives, maybe in your board of advisors, you can do that. Try to get a board of advisors that has a variety of backgrounds and opinions. Try to get other partners involved or some of the vendors that you bring in to help you with different things. So you can create that variety in a number of different ways that is different from the way, let's say, a large organization would do it by hiring different types of team members and so forth. But you can still get the benefit of having those different perspectives. I think people like you and I, who interview people all the time that come from different backgrounds, I've interviewed artificial intelligence experts. And in the process of talking to them, it's given me a whole new view of what the possibilities are, the constraints are, that I probably would have never thought of before if it hadn't been because that person gave me that perspective. On the other end of the spectrum, then I'll talk to someone else who's a specialist in choice theory, and they're talking about the various drivers that motivate human behavior. And as you talk to these different people, all these ideas begin to percolate that wouldn't percolate if I was talking to 100 Joe Santanas.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, it's quite remarkable, isn't it? Like but once again, it just gets back to the sort of simplicity of it. Like it's seemingly so simple just to have a conversation with people. But I think there's certainly for me too, like the idea of a willingness to do something, like to either introduce like some new idea or new person, or even the willingness to look at something in a different way, like willingness to do it, for me is almost like the first step, like the key sort of point to start at. Because if you don't have, there's different probably interpretations of willingness to do things. Like you can just be, you know, naturally like trying all sorts of different things, and you just have general curiosity. But like a curiosity about something, like we were saying before, like it's not a guarantee. And a lot of people like to have a guarantee that, which is, I guess, for many people based on what they've done before, they know it works. Yeah, so just keep doing that. And I guess there's nothing wrong with that. Like that's a sort of a solid, that's sensible, I suppose. Yep. That's That's like, that's not, you know, once again, it's not either black or white, or not like right or left. It's either, it's much more nuanced than that. Like, but at the same time, you know, I feel like you can actually quite easily have both if you've got willingness to look at it a different way. If it doesn't end up being right, well, you know, you tried. You know, I mean, gave it a shot. I was like, no, it's actually like that approach. We gave it a shot. Maybe a little part of that is good, you know.
Absolutely. I will tell you though that investors are becoming increasingly interested and focused on this when it comes to companies. Like so investors care only about two things, right? You know, in not to make them two-dimensional characters, but primarily their drive in putting money into a company is A, it's going to pay good dividends now, and B, it's going to appreciate in value. So I'm buying this stock now at X dollars. 10 years from now, it'll be worth double X, triple X, whatever. Investors are now looking at organizations under the environmental, social, and governance umbrella, or ESG. And that social and governance element has a lot to do with the way that organizations are effective in terms of bringing in people from a variety of backgrounds, supporting their success in producing value for the organization, addressing these larger markets. Now, why do investors care about this? Well, number one is because there are a bunch of reports out there that show that I think one of the most recent ones was one that said that companies that have these workforces that are more diverse and that are effectively run are 35% more productive in performance, in their economic performance. So they're seeing that there's a bottom line impact. That's the dividend side of the equation. The other reason is, on the other end of the spectrum, as you look at the changes that are happening as we're moving deeper into the 21st century, if you're invested in a company that is not going to have products or services that appeal to a changing market, then that stock is not going to appreciate over a period of time. It may actually become stagnant, or it may actually shrink in value. So investors now are applying these tools to look at these organizations from the standpoint of, and the E in ESG stands for environmental, but it's, are you a polluter, or are you a company that operates in a way that's beneficial? Are we in danger of getting sued because you're throwing garbage into the local river and that's going to affect shareholder value? Are you able to bring in and effectively manage a workforce made up of women and all the other people that now have joined the workforce? Or are you still only able to manage people that somehow contort themselves into your 20th century policies? And how's that going to affect your ability to perform economically? Because again, they're looking at a portfolio and they want to put their money where it's going to give them the best economic value add. And then looking at the future, are you a company that, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to be able to either pass on to my children or grandchildren or sell at 10x? Or are you going to be a worthless penny stock? Or are you going to even exist? So this is, again, something that is important for organizational leaders to take account of. In fact, in the United States, I know right now that the SEC is starting to take steps to require certain types of disclosure on the part of companies so that investors can use that information to make decisions about whether they want to put their money into that company or not. And these investors are not looking for cute little things like, oh, it's LGBTQ month, so we're going to put little rainbows on our website. What they're looking for is, are you concretely able to produce results with this new workforce that meets the needs of this new marketplace?
Yeah.
That's the big question.
Yeah. I think whilst that's obviously everything you're talking about, but I think like the perspective that you're providing for this whole topic is a really important one because it sort of steers it away from what I mentioned sort of at the start is this this very easy single-minded sort of thing that can be sloganized and sort of turned into whatever people want to turn it into online, that if you're talking about diversity and equity and inclusion, therefore it's a I was trying to think what people would say, like they as this view that therefore that means it's not practical, it's not it's not, hasn't got real results, it's just this ideal that when applied to business hasn't got real results, and in fact it will cause more problems than it has solutions, which is like anything that people choose to sloganize and turn into something, like it's the proof is in the pudding, is like if anything, you could apply it to just about anything. If you apply an ideal to something and it's got a great effect for things you want to have it a great effect on, well, then it's probably good, But then, if it's not, and, it's just applied in an ad hoc sort of way. I mean, if you do that in something like sport, which is like the great sort of equalizer with things, if you don't perform, you don't win. Even if you're the best in your field on the day, and that's what I love about all sport, is you've got to perform like on the day,
that's right.
It's got to
produce results. And here's a quick example that I can offer you of how, like, let's say a DEI effort can produce results. So I mentioned in my own history how one of the things that we were finding is, as we were bringing more women into the organization, the organization was doing a great job of selling, outsourcing deals. But in order to be able to realize revenue, you have to start serving the customer. And to do that, you have to have leaders that you can put into those accounts to run the operation. If the leadership bench gets tight or small, then you've got a signed contract, but you can't deliver. There's no revenue. So one of the things that I discovered was that the way that our organization was set up, if a male came into the organization, the training was set up in such a way that his chances of being able to get to that leadership bench and eventually get assigned to one of those accounts was pretty high. When a female came into the organization, it wasn't so high. In fact, it was astronomically low, right? So I'm sitting there and saying, I'm starving, revenue starving, because sales is closing, but at my leadership bench is weak. And the reason why is because I'm dependent totally on my male workers here. And I don't have any women that actually are being properly brought into this bench. I had HR make a couple of tweaks to how they did certain training programs and certain parts of the program. More women started floating to the top. Those women then were on the leadership bench as well. They ended up getting assigned to accounts. Okay, who's the winner here as a result of this? The women were winners because now they had an opportunity to ascend to leadership roles. But the company was a winner because now they ended up earning more revenue. And in fact, me and all my managers were winners because there was a component of our bonus that was based on company performance. And the company was doing better, therefore our bonuses were all fatter. So every ship went up when that tide went up. And in many cases in an organization, if you've got an organization that has women in the sales team and they can't perform as well as the men because the rules are set up in such a way that they are somewhat handicapped, then that means that, let's say you get to 50-50, 50% women, 50% men. Your men are firing on all cylinders. Your women can't. That affects your company's bottom line. That affects everybody's performance bonus that has a component that's based on that bottom line. Make a tweak, the women do better, they earn more, but the pie expands, and now everyone does better. So it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game where in order for Group A to win, we have to take something away from Group B. Mm-hmm. We actually can all win by effectively making that transition of being able to tap more deeply and support, make better measures to support that new workforce so that we can all perform better economically. It's good for the careers of people that are part of that new workforce, but it's also good for the company. It's good for everybody else that's there.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, I think it's an incredibly important message. And like I was sort of saying before, I think that you know, the more conversations, you know, everyone can just generally have, like, using the same methods that we're doing now, like, to realize, like, even with the battleground that is the internet, you know, of the battleground of sort of ideas of you know, of people saying all sorts of you know, random stuff that they don't really think through. That just adds more fuel onto the fire. You know, the best thing you can do is to actually have conversations, not that are even just like we're having, which is, you know, is generally very supportive of the whole idea, but even having conversations, you know, with other people who don't agree, who actually don't agree, who've got, once again, like, a different opinion, because at least then in my mind, like, that's then reflective of the very idea that you're talking about of, you know, being that if you're going to be advocating, you know, things that are diverse and equity and inclusion, then that can't exclude oppositional ideas, and it shouldn't in fact, because
absolutely,
you know, because if you're excluding that, then you're immediately canceling out everything you're talking about, because, like, you're going against what you know you have to be able to, you know, which is, it's not easy, like, it's, you know, who really wants to have an argument,
you know,
I want to talk with Joe because I know for a fact that he's got the exact opposite view, and there's a pretty high likelihood we're going to get into some sort of argument. Yeah, that's no fun. Like, that's
no, of course not. Of course
not. Sucks. You know, I mean, you don't want to do that.
Of course not.
But if both people are, like, you know, just generally sensible, and you're going to have a debate, I mean, a debate's different to an argument, you know, because nobody,
yes,
there's nothing positive generally comes from having an argument. I don't really believe, like, there's not much point in arguing, but a debate is different. You could have, like, a heated debate, you know, at least find something you agree upon, and then, you know, even if that's a little bit, I think that's good, because then it says to everyone listening, like, if you're going, okay, we want to move, we don't want to, you know, even not saying this side of talking about, you know, everything we've been talking about in this podcast is, like, 100% the right way. It's good and it's important for all the reasons we've been talking about. But is there somebody with another view as to why they think it's not, or they've got a different angle on it? Good. You know, include them, because that might just mean that, you know, not only do they have a different perspective on what we've been talking about, but, you know, other people might go, actually, what we've been doing is a little bit, you know, maybe we can learn something, like, from what they're saying. Who knows? But once again, it's no guarantee, is it? Like, it's not a guarantee that you're going to, and that everyone's going to come out the other end, you know, being 100% on the same page.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the only thing that you can hope for, and I think that when the one way that you prevent, in many cases, from having an argument and focus more on having what you a healthy debate, it could be a heated debate, but a healthy debate, is when you anchor around facts instead of opinions can be so varied. Like we can both agree, you know, that a particular object is, you know, a red popsicle. What we may not agree on is that it's a good popsicle or a bad popsicle, right? There is no way that I can argue with you and convince you that red popsicles are good popsicles or the other way around if my belief is the opposite. But we should be able to agree on the color and the object that's in front of us. So what I usually say is, look, do we agree on the demographic facts? This is where if you look at the children that are now 11 years old and you look at the demographics of the children and you make the assumption that the people that are older are going to die and that these kids are going to become the next generation, you can pretty much predict with some accuracy what the demographic makeup is going to be of the next generation. It's the children as adults, right? So that's going to be the new workforce. So that's a fact. Now, if you think that this bodes disaster, that's an opinion. If you think this bodes opportunity, that's another opinion. I would say that in a leadership position, I would look at this and I would say to myself, what does this mean for my product, my market, what I do, how I do it, and what am I going to do or what do I plan to do to address this? To simply retrench and say, well, I don't like this, I don't want this to happen, and therefore I'm not going to deal with it. That's the head in the sand approach. That's not useful. But to think through what it is that you plan to do. Like, for example, right now in the United States, we have people that feel very extreme about a lot of things. They're very pro one thing and very con the other. And then you have these companies that are selling products and services. And we recently had one. It was a beer company, Anheuser-Busch. They sell Bud Light. And during the Super Bowl commercial, they had as their spokesperson someone who cross-dresses and is a transsexual. And they did this as an attempt to capture a younger market that tends to be a little more socially liberal. You know, they felt our beer sales are declining or not doing as well. Let's grab this new market. Then the remaining clients that they have in their old market said, that's terrible. You know, they're anti all this, transsexuals and so forth. And one person who does some stuff on the internet, took a case of beer, took a shotgun and put a bullet through the case of beer and uploaded the video to the internet as a protest. Now, the company comes out and says, we didn't mean to offend anyone. We want to bring people together over a bottle of beer. Their sales plummeted. Why? Because they made a decision, or at least they thought they made a decision, to strategically chase a new growing market. But then when they got a reaction from their old market, they got scared and they retrenched. So now they look like hypocrites to the new market and they look like phonies to their old market and nobody's buying their beer. And what I say to companies is there's no way that you can actually serve multiple masters, as it were. Mm. And in today's society, you literally have to decide based on my values, my morals, the company I'm running, what it is that we sell, what do we stand for, and what are we going to pursue? But don't try to be all things to all people because that doesn't work anymore. And that was an old tactic that organizations had, was to sort of stand in the middle and think, well, you know, we could sell our wares to everyone. That world doesn't exist anymore. So literally, you have to position yourself as being for something, and whatever that is, you have to realize that you're going to lose some market share on the other side. Ideally, the market that you lose is a lot smaller than the market that you gain. A case in point being Nike sneakers. When Nike took a controversial quarterback and made them their spokesperson, they alienated a large part of their old market. But the new market that they were pursuing was so much bigger and bought so much more of the product that the loss they had on one side was more than supplemented for by the other. They ended up $1 billion ahead of the game as a result of that. But had they turned around and said, oh, we're sorry, old market, we didn't mean to do that, we really stand for everything and nothing at the same time, they would have lost both. They would have lost both markets.
It's incredible. Yeah, it's so risky, isn't it? Like it's a because that very subject that you were speaking about before with, I mean, the beer company has been, you know, here in Australia too. I mean, it's all over the internet, and there's a million videos about it, and it seems to be swamping everybody's feeds. It's from my perspective too. Like even if you take out all the cultural aspects, that they, you know, had a certain market and then they changed over to a seemingly polar opposite sort of market, or in the eyes of the people from the previous market. Like even from that perspective, if you take out that part of it, the cultural part of it, for me, looking at it, I mean, never having drunk like a Bud Light, because I don't think we even have it here in Australia. Maybe we do, I'm not sure. But like even seeing that, the first time I saw it, I just thought, you know, not even from a cultural point of view with Dylan Mulvaney, I think the guy's name was.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, you know, the whole thing that was going on with the marketing campaign. I thought, why would you do that? Because it was like for me saying, like, one day you're selling, like, say if you're selling clothing and boots to cowboys, then the next day you're saying our new market is punk rockers. Like it just seemed to make absolutely no sense to me. Like not having any like incredible amount of information about who Bud Light sold their beer to, but you know, you find out very quickly on the internet and all the videos of people just being angry about it. And I thought, like, even outside of the cultural perspective, I thought that didn't, like, why would a marketing department do that? Like, even if you were going to do that, right? Now, we work in marketing, that even if you're going to do that, which is fine, like that's an okay strategy to have. Even if you're going to do that, why not just, from a practical point of view, introduce it slowly, like have another campaign, introduce it in a different way instead of going, okay, we're all out, we're all in.
They made a quick turn, but I think that the big lesson for them, I even used the term, you know, when I wrote an article that's coming out soon, where one of the pieces of advice that I give, you know, CEOs in my article is don't Bud Light yourself, right? And what I mean by that is that, from my perspective, the mistake that they made wasn't so much in the turn from a market to another market. It was in the wishy-washy response. It's like, if you're going to do something, if you're going to commit, and you're betting the company, because that's what they were doing, they were betting the company somewhat or betting the brand. If you're going to do something like that, you have to expect that there's going to be a backlash. You have to already have estimated what that backlash is going to be like to some degree, and you have to be ready for how you're going to respond to that backlash. So what was the motivation? The motivation was that they were seeing that their sales numbers weren't climbing the way they were before. They were flattening a little bit, and they were looking for a way. It's a light beer, so they were looking for a way to capture a new market. Half of the people that reacted to this probably don't even drink the light product, because they're more, like you said, the cowboy types, right? they probably drink the heavier product, but they reacted to the brand. So if you're looking at this as a larger brand strategy and you say to yourself, yeah, I'm ready to jump toward this other market because this is my future market. I estimate that the total available market here is huge. This market is in decline or it's stagnated somewhat, or I want to rebrand my image, whatever it is that you decide. Once you make that decision, the worst thing that you can do is then turn around and say, oops, no, we really don't want to offend anyone. It's like, but the reason why that happens is it was really interesting. A couple of years ago, I was at a meeting with a bunch of people that were primarily like the senior most HR representatives in a company. And I was a guest there. And one of the things that I mentioned to them is, look, the era where you can hide and say we're neutral because we want to sell our products to Democrats, Republicans, short people, tall people, or whatever, that era is almost over. You're either going to take a stand or you're going to be pushed into a place of irrelevance. And everyone there said, no, our CEOs don't want to take a stand and so forth. Well, guess what? We're there in that era now. You have to take a stand. And once you take that stand, you have to be able to support it.
Yeah, no, true. I mean, that translates to trust, I think. You know, it's like it, you know, in any human behavior, probably, you know, if I say to you, hey, Joe, you know, I think this is right. And then the next day I go, and that's actually, I didn't actually really think that at all. I just said that to you because I want to make you feel good.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It'd be like,
I don't feel so good anymore after that either.
Yeah, right? It'd be like, what are you talking about? I was like, yeah, I just want to make you feel good. It was actually all a lie. You know, see ya.
Yeah.
And then, and you'd be like, wow, that makes me feel terrible because I trusted you.
Exactly. And like, think of the employees that are in the company. The employees that are in the company that were hired and given that mission.
Yeah.
Were then put on leave and told, you know, go over there and wait and, you know, on the bubble until we figure out what to do.
Yeah.
If I were an employee of that organization now, and, you know, I'm speaking again as an outsider, I'm not in the organization, but if I was an employee of the organization, I would seriously doubt whether or not the senior leadership of that company has my back when they send me out on a mission. Yeah, when they send me out on a mission, absolutely, I would seriously then say, well, wait a minute.
Yeah, there's suspicion.
Know, why don't you give me an exit package in case this thing falls apart, and let's sign it first so that if you want me to fall on my sword, I'll fall on my sword and I'll walk out well compensated, right? But but just on a handshake, that trust is gone. That trust has got to be gone because they just hung them out to dry.
And really, this is like sort of something I remember from doing, I mean, martial arts. There's some saying that I think it was from my head instructor or somebody saying about the trust. The trust that like a student has with the, you know, instructor and vice versa. That once the trust is gone, you can't really regain it. Like even if you made amends, or you know, once it's gone, it's kind of gone. You can't.
Yep.
And I think that's true. But just to, on a last point, like on that sort of topic, I feel that like say for what happened with that whole event, I feel the primary thing that actually caused the whole problem, like there was obviously the backlash and then the flip-flop, but I feel there was, I think the marketing manager, the lady who she had this thing that's been like, you know, reshown probably thousands and thousands of times of her sort of spiel about why they were doing the campaign. And I think that was the linchpin about why people got onto it so quickly, was because I feel that maybe it wouldn't have been so bad or wouldn't have gotten so much publicity and, like, well, maybe not flown under the radar because that probably wouldn't have happened, but, like, her putting out this message, people latched onto it, and given the internet having the nature that it does and the viral nature, then for people who have, completely opposite views, other people, et cetera, it just spread like wildfire. And that was the thing that then, you know, put this like laser focus on it.
Yep.
This laser-like focus on this topic that, you know, I don't think would have been like such a huge thing. In fact, the campaign itself, from what I understand, was just like an anniversary sort of campaign or something. It wasn't like that was going to be like their new brand forever, because it wasn't. It was just like this thing that was like a one-off thing, which, I mean, heaps of marketing agencies and agencies like us do things like that all the time. There's like one-off campaigns doing this or that. And it's not like that was going to be how it was forever, but all of a sudden, in all these other people's minds, it is, because of, you know, I mean, to get back to your point about, you know, got to choose A or B, and she chose A, and then it changed, but without the, you know, sort of consent or the, I mean, like, I don't know the story, but it sort of seemed like she'd gone off on her own. But in any event, if that wasn't the case, or it was, the effect that it had, like you were saying, like the key point is still that they didn't stick to their guns on it and say, you know, well, you know, we want to do this for this reason, and we felt it was important, you know. And they could have actually, I think, like, actually made some good, you know, sort of conversation around that. Like, really, if they had just sort of not been so fearful, and it still would have been fearful for the company, but not as bad as saying, oh, we changed our minds and we sacked that girl now. And, you know.
Yep. Yeah. No, I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, with your experience in marketing, I mean, a commercial that would have gotten some attention because of the backlash and everything else started getting a lot of attention. That's a lot of kinetic energy. If you harness that kinetic energy and you use it the right way, and you, like, let's say, for example, if you turned around and you doubled down on what you did and support even more broadly for these other groups, if you did that, you'd get this entire other echo chamber of people now who feel like, oh, you represent, you're like us, right?
Yeah.
And you, and they would then amplify your message. It would become then a meme everywhere, but it would be a positive meme. But in the middle of this situation, you turn around, you know, and you turn tail. It's kind of like, you either run into the wind and it lifts you up into the air, or you run away from it and it crushes you, right? Or it throws you off the side of the hill. So, you know, I think that that's the, so when making decisions like that, I think that's the important thing for organizations to remember. It's like baseball. You don't hit a home run and just stay standing there to make your home run. You've got to leave the safety of home plate and start running around the bases.
Yeah. I think the shame about situations like that is that it casts the wrong sort of light onto what we're talking about. Like it casts this sort of, you know, not for everybody, but I saw it happen with, do you remember that sort of series that came out, The Rings of Power? It was like the Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
I'm a huge like Lord of the Rings fan, and I was really interested when that came out. And it wasn't, you know, it was okay, you know. But I wager definitely that it was like a very similar, like, in my observation about what happened with the Rings of Power, is that The Rings of Power had, I think it was like the lady who played like one of the dwarves. She came out and she had, she seemed very sort of nice and really lively, but she came out and she was, she had sort of a statement on some shows and things about inclusion, for black women and things, which, you know, I mean, like who, that's all fine. But the internet went, whoa, hang on a second. Like Lord of the Rings doesn't have like, you know, there's like, we shouldn't be including these things in like Lord of the Rings. And then it took on this like life on its own, which for me was really like, I had more humor and interest watching it because it turned something that, whilst it wasn't like the best show ever, and you know, heaps of Lord of the Rings fans would be like, yeah, you know, it's okay, had its moments, but it became so much worse because it got, you know, it had this like other thing attached to it, you know, rightly or wrongly, in the eyes of like millions of people, that it was then like linked, like a bit of like mud got thrown on it, which shouldn't really, like the topic of all that shouldn't really, in theory, shouldn't really have had any any negative effect, you know, but then it did, and then YouTube was like filled with all these like joke sort of videos about it, and I actually felt really like, whilst the show wasn't great, I actually felt really sorry in a funny way for the people who made the series, because I thought they've obviously put a huge amount of effort into it, crazy amount of effort.
Sure.
And then it's just got canned out of the gates. It didn't even have a chance. It didn't even have a chance. Even if it's not the best show ever, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
It got like smashed as soon as it came out of the gates. It's like the horses started to bolt, and the riders just like jumped off, and they were, you know,
It's how people interpret things. Like, for example, one interpretation of the whole Bud Light thing is like, oh, stay away from that topic because it's dangerous. But if you explore it a little more deeply, Nike did the same thing and they made $1 billion, but they doubled down on their bet. They said people actually started burning their sneakers when they picked this quarterback and putting stuff on the internet. And they basically turned around and said, we as a corporation believe in blah, 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 and this is what we're supporting, and we're sorry that you feel the way you do. And we've appreciated your patronage in the past, and if you want to continue, that's fine, but this is our commitment. And boom, they took off. They showed backbone. They took off, right? The other company turns around and does this flip-flop, and it's the flip-flop piece that hurt more than anything else. The other thing is that we're at this point where we have all these different things going on, these different tensions that are going on, and they show up in the most incredibly funny, sometimes bizarre ways. Like, for example, I saw a posting on the internet recently. They had the actress, she's half black, half white, Halle Berry, played the Little Mermaid. And, you know, I saw a couple of internet postings about some upsetness over that a black actress was playing the Little Mermaid. And I'm sitting here and thinking, she's fictitious. She's fictitious, right? It's like, what is your problem with, she could be Asian. She could be anything. She could be an alien. She's fictitious. That's like turning around and saying, well, you know, we really have a problem. You know, I'm a Trekkie. I like Star Trek. We really have a problem with the fact that one of the Andorians is played by an Asian man. And I'm like, there are no Andorians. You know? It's like the problem is in your head. These things don't exist, right?
Yeah, it's funny. There was like huge debate, and I think I saw like a couple of these videos because I was just like, I really want to hear what people have to say on the whole, like, Lord of the Rings thing. And in fact, I've been actually listening to the audiobook of like Lord of the Rings again, sort of recently, because hadn't actually read it for ages. And whilst there's like no specific mention of, you know, black, Asian, white, you know, Andorian, you know, whatever, you know, in all the, whilst there's different, like, you know, cultures, like orcs are black and this is that, and like men from Gondor are white, etc. There's also, you know, if you want to get technical, there's no specific mention that other types of people don't exist in the Lord of the Rings. So, you know, if you're gonna start to have this argument, which of which there's like many amongst like a bazillion Lord of the Rings nerds getting like, hang on a second, you know, there's no, they don't mention this. Like, well, actually they don't, if you want to get technical, they don't not mention it either. You know, that there's nothing
it's
to
in
say.
Here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just because
it's all in here. It's what we picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because, and you know, everybody sees themselves in like things that they like, and you sort of, you reflect yourself in someone or something, because it's, you know, it's sort of, I guess in many ways make sense to do that. You feel comfortable, it makes you feel at home because there's people like you. But that's kind of
exactly,
that's kind of almost, it's like the little tiny seed of sort of racism, you know, if it grows into like a certain sort of tree. You know, it becomes then sort of something, then you're not like me, and then that's bad, and then it turns into other things. But then, you know, it's funny then in, you know, that it was this, you know, in Under Rings of Power, they were like, well, there's no like black dwarves. I'm like, well, how do you know? Or maybe there were. Maybe there were black dwarves. You know,
this, I always find those conversations hilarious. It's like,
that's so what, silly.
Like hobbits, what are they exactly? Are they black? Are they white? Are they, you know, are they Asian? What are they? What are, you know, wizards and stuff like that? These are fantasy creatures. And essentially, when we're reading the book, to your point, we project our own imagery into it, because that's what we have. That's the stuff in our imagination that we have to create whatever fantasy world we create. Then we go to a movie and we expect to see what we've got in our head projected on the screen. Mm. And that's where the disconnect comes from. It has nothing to do with anything other than that. These are fictitious characters.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. So, well, as we're probably sort of nearing the end of our podcast, Joe, I'll ask you at this point, like I mentioned at the start, if you've got some a quote or something relevant or something that you'd like to share with everyone, what would that be?
Well, I think, you know, based on everything we're talking about, I actually jotted something down when you first told me you were going to ask me this toward the end. And it turns out that everything that we talked about kind of can mesh with this. So basically it's this. The past can scream at the future as loud as it wants to, but the future is not listening. What's coming is coming, and the signals of how the world is changing are going to continue marching on, the same as the Industrial Revolution, the same as the automobile, the same as all these other things. And the question left for us then as leaders is, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to respond to these things in a way that's beneficial to ourselves, our companies, and the people who work with us?
I think all sensible people would at least listen to that. If not, argue with it, definitely on the internet. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people, but yeah, I think that's a really great way to sort of to wrap up the podcast, but just before we go, can you tell everyone about how best to we'll have a link with the podcast, but can you tell everyone the best way to like to get in contact to learn more about what you do?
Sure. So you can visit my website. It's www.joesantana, one word, joesantana.com. I'm very easy to find on LinkedIn. I'm all over social media as well, although I try to avoid the controversies about the race and ethnicity of dwarves. But other than that, I'm very available and always open and happy to talk to people about different topics and get their perspectives.
Yeah, no, that's great, Joe. And it's been a great conversation, really, really interesting. And thank you so much once again, like, for being on the podcast. Any last words?
Well, my one last word before I say anything else is thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I know that the last time we were supposed to talk, I realized at last minute that it was around 2 o'clock in the morning, my time. But this worked out a lot better. So it's really been a pleasure talking to you. And hopefully what I look forward to is that what we talked about today is a conversation starter. I don't think of it as the answer to all questions, but rather something that gets people talking and thinking, especially people who are business leaders, own organizations, or have some kind of leadership responsibility.
I think that's a key point and a great way to finish it. And so with that in mind, that's actually it for today, everyone. Thanks so much for listening into our podcast yet again. Before we go, please leave your feedback as well as any suggestions for any topics you would like us to discuss in future episodes. And thanks again for listening to the Grow Your Business podcast, and we'll see you again soon. Bye, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.